ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Keith Valerie, CEO of Plex. Plex is a streaming media app that organizes users' favorite content and streams it to all their devices. Keith and his team have a unique perspective and approach to the best way to build a software user experience company and are working to provide consumers an easier way to discover, organize, and enjoy the content they love. Keith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So first, for those listeners who are not aware, what is Plex?
So Plex is a streaming media app that allows people to, today, allows people to organize all of their media, so their video collections, music collections, photo collections, etc., and then stream them to all of their devices. We've also integrated live TV and DVR functionality into the product, and as we announced earlier this year, we're integrating news and other content over time as well. So the idea is that you shouldn't have to go to a whole bunch of different apps to get access to the content you want. You should have one beautiful app that allows you to organize and manage your content and kind of personalize the way your view of that content looks. And then you should be able to access that wherever you are. So if you're on your mobile phone or your Xbox or a TV, whatever, a smart TV, you should be able to get that content. So today we have apps on virtually every platform, 4.5-star rated app, and we're in the top 10 most watched apps on most streaming platforms.
So. Wow. So it isn't a piece of hardware. It's an app that lives on devices. Just one.
Absolutely. And we ride on the kind of app platforms of all the other smart devices out there.
So is it free or do I subscribe? What is the price structure of that?
Yeah, so most of the functionality is free. So the kind of the magic of being able to organize that content and then stream it to different devices, that's all free. And then we have what we call FlexPass, which is our premium service that allows people to get premium features like syncing content to a device for offline viewing, parental controls, a bunch of cool metadata data things and related content. So about 15% of our monthly active users subscribe, but we're happy to get more and more users for free as well, because that just kind of spreads the word.
Right. And you also, one of the really unique things is you host people's personal content, right? So their personal photos, or if they have giant old time record collections or CD collections. I mean, even those are old nowadays. So is that correct too?
Absolutely correct.
And how,
so, one of the important things about the kind of the personal media aspect is, we've built in a lot of security into the product.
That was actually my next question. Yeah, like privacy, right?
Yeah. I think it's one of the things that people love about us. We have over probably now 12, 13 million registered users. More than half of those users are outside of the U.S. I think one of the things that's kind of propelled us to where we are now is that we provide not only a beautiful and easy to use solution, but more importantly, a really secure solution for content that you have in your home. So we don't have access to it. We provide end-to-end encryption for streaming from each computer to each device, which is, we think, one of the largest security deployments on the planet. I'm not sure if anybody else is doing that type of security. So that has been a big kind of claim to fame for us.
So is that something that you guys developed internally, or did you partner with somebody to do that level of security? And you must constantly be updating it. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have a lot of the security and privacy and, just architecture that we've done is in-house, but we partner with DigiCert for actually being able to give the little green lock in the top corner and kind of demonstrate the security from point to point.
Right. Okay, great. And so really it sounds like the biggest things, I mean, certainly for me as a user and also in my business, what I'm seeing is you're really attacking those two big things of content discovery and also user experience, right? I mean, that's really.
I think, we view ourselves actually as a user experience company. We have probably almost 10% of our employees are either in design or user experience. And so we think that's the biggest problem to be solved here, right? Like, a lot of problems are being solved with the amount of content that's available. The disaggregation of content, I think, generally makes content less expensive, but the chaos of being able to figure right. out where it is and how to organize that is a problem that nobody's really solving cross-platform. Certainly, a lot of companies are kind of solving it in their own ecosystems, and I think doing some great work around universal discovery and universal search and things like that and organizing content better. But being able, you know, essentially have an app or a user experience that works across platform that's kind of available no matter what, and more importantly, allows you to personalize it and organize it the way you want. Nobody's doing that yet. So we hope we've got a little runway.
So if I'm a user, is my experience a Plex experience? Like if I'm watching something through Netflix, am I inside the Netflix app and world, or am I inside my Plex app and world? And how is that experience?
Yeah. And to be clear, so today, if you go to Netflix, you're just in the Netflix app for sure.
Okay.
We don't integrate Netflix or Hulu or a lot of those.
Okay,
things.
Sorry. So
I think over time, and this, you know, this is one of the things I think it's fair to say, like there's no plans right now to integrate into Netflix. But where we think the industry should go is that you should absolutely have apps, and that there'll be, you know, I think this is going to happen whether Plex does it or not. There's going to be apps and user experiences that allow people to kind of go into one place to get to all the content that they want. So you could see in the future where if there's, you know, kind of in the user experience that you want and you click the show that you want, you're not clicking into an app, you're clicking into the show or the movie or the whatever, and it's going to launch you deep link into one of those apps or whatnot. Again, that's way out in the future. I think we have a lot. We're kind of tackling and trying to overserve underserved markets and build users that way. And to be fair, a lot of our users today, I think, are kind of the early adopter, influencer, innovative users who like really care about a really good user experience. But over time, we want to kind of start picking off those things where we get to mainstream. And my hope is that channels like Netflix and Hulu and HBO and others, you know, can all be available in a beautiful user experience at some point.
Right. When we're talking about user experience, a couple of weeks ago, I was at the TV of Tomorrow conference, and one of the things we were talking about around user experience was voice. How are you guys thinking about voice and integrating voice into your service?
Yeah, so today we work with Alexa, and we're working on Google Home stuff as well. And we are because we're an app that sits on other platforms, we're essentially taking into consideration the voice recognition on those platforms. So you can use voice control and with your Xbox and things like that. But we're not, you know.
So it's not something that you guys are developing. It's something that you're leveraging that exists on the platform that the person who happens to have Plex has.
Exactly. They're building the voice infrastructure. We kind of tie into it. It's a fair way to get on the, we are, I think, the only one syllable skill on Alexa to say Plex, please open, blah, blah, blah. So there's a lot of work that goes into making sure you can tie into those things. We think it's an important, you know, it's definitely an important medium, just like VR is an important medium and other things that we're kind of stretching to make sure that we're in those arenas. But today, a lot of the infrastructure
just,
you know,
isn't there.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm personally
frustrated by voice. I just don't use it very much. I don't have Siri turned on my phone. It just doesn't, it's not up to snuff for me personally, but I get it. You know, it's not that it's not going to get there one day.
Well, it's interesting. There was a certain amount of debate about that at the conference. And if we launch too soon and people have a rubbishy experience, then they won't try it. You know, that you can't go to market too soon with it, but that's
I think it's kind of a standard, you know, at least what I've heard in the industry and prior companies and seen from time to time is that the general thought is if a mainstream customer, there's definitely early adopters and innovators who are willing to put up with a little more crap, you know, of what's happening. But the mainstream customer, and I would put myself in that boat, is if they try something and it doesn't work, you've lost them for 3 years. It's going to take 3 years.
Really?
People to come back and say, no, you got to try this, you got to try this, you got to try this. And then they'll come back and try it again. So I do think, you know, all of this, but 3 years goes quickly.
That's,
you know,
true. That's true. But still, 3 years sounds like you can start and die in 3 years if you're trying to do something. That's interesting.
One of the things that we've done, we still gate our apps because the Plex historically has taken a fair amount of setup time, right? And by a fair amount, it takes you 10 or 15 minutes to get Plex up and running and kind of
input. Yeah, but in today's goldfish attention span, that's a challenge, right?
A long time. So what we've purposely done over the last few years is actually limited growth. I think we probably could have grown faster, but you'd risk creating that kind of tension with making users mad and losing them for a long time. So we've kind of purposely gated this by having the mobile apps cost $5, which is a huge price even though it's the price of a latte, it's still a big price and a big barrier. And we've done that specifically so that we don't, anger the person who has a short attention span and isn't willing to put up 10 or 15 minutes to get their things up and running.
Isn't it funny then? So the price point actually means the person is more interested in it, and because they're more interested in it, they're more willing to give it a little time. Is that the
absolutely? So if you look at our current user base, because they've put in a little bit of time, and I think that's why our conversion rate is at 15%. That's a crazy high conversion rate. And arguably it's too high. If you wanted to optimize on getting more users in, you'd somehow make the barriers down. And I think we could do that. But we really wanted to make sure that the people that we get, and I think that's another reason why our apps are 4.5, stars, like people get in and they put in a little bit of time, and it's very sticky then, and they love it, and they'll give it a good rating. My guess is if we just drop the price to zero, you'd get a bunch of 1-stars. People are like, what? I'm not spending 10 minutes doing
this. Sure. That's interesting. People and their willingness to do something, but then the valuing it a little higher, a little more. So part of the discovery piece, do you guys also have an algorithm that helps like a recommendation engine? Or is it really that people themselves are saying, I want this thing? I mean, how much does the user have to know what they want? How much is fed to them as a recommendation?
Yeah, so we have a lot of basic recommendation built in, and we've had that for a while. So being able to do simple pivots on, more like this artist, or recently, recently added, or, those types of things have been in the product for a while. And I think we do a really nice job the way in fact, I know I'm not naming any names, but there's definitely a number of large companies out there who kind of copied the way that we do some of the things that we do. And it's kind of flattering, and we have no problem with that. We kind of hopefully will continue to lead on some of those things. But with the acquisition of WatchUp, which is this news service, was similar to Plex. So the idea is being able to personalize and organize the news that you care about and make sure that the sources are really high quality. We've got 160 publishers in, and they're big names like CNN and CBS and Fox and others. But with that acquisition, we got some machine learning and AI capabilities, because the amount of content you're dealing with is so massive that you have to build in a lot of tech to help make that work better. And we've been adding additional machine learning and AI resources as well. So I think a big part, if we're going to pull off what we want to pull off, which is, being this kind of first stop, the first place that you go to get to the content that you care about. And in the grand scheme of things, we're talking about an almost infinite amount of content.
Right.
We're going to have some really amazing machine learning and AI to help us get there.
So you teed it up perfectly. My question was, I was going to ask is you acquired WatchUp, and then more recently you launched Plex Live TV and the DVR. And so were you leveraging that WatchUp model, sort of what WatchUp had developed with the local news affiliates and the national news, in order to get these other content providers on board?
Good question. I actually hadn't thought that people might, because of the order of battle in terms of releasing and PR, I hadn't really thought that people might put that together that way. But actually,
the reverse?
Yeah, it's actually kind of the reverse. We had been working on a lot of the live TV. We have integrated EPG from Gracenote into the system. That actually there was a fair amount of work that went into that. And so we've been, the live TV and DVR stuff had been in the hopper for, a year and a half or so. And why that was so important for us, and this is a little bit geeky, but why that was so important for us is that it forced us, and the reason we kind of decided to go with over the air, and live TV and more kind of a cord cutter, almost niche market there, that it forced us to rethink the way our user experience and UI works to be more content first than location first. In a world where we're just managing people's personal libraries of content. The most obvious kind of top level UI point is location. Where is the content? Okay, now what content do you have there and how do you get it to a device? In a world where you start bringing in content from lots of different sources, not just your source, but your own content, but live TV and streaming services and other content providers, you kind of have to switch that on its head and say, okay, the first thing you want to do is, do I want to watch a movie? Okay, now what sources are available to me, and kind of abstract that away. And so live TV and DVR did a number of things. One, the cool thing is that because you can record that content locally, it gets to take advantage of all the awesome things that we do, the metadata and the streaming and all of that. So it was something that we could use right out of the gate with all of our tech. Second, because of our user base, we have kind of a more, again, innovator, early adopter user base. They've been asking us for the live TV and tuner integration for a long time.
Right.
But third, probably, again, strategic, those are kind of tactical, right?
Right.
Strategically for us, it was, okay, let's use this as the catalyst to kind of shift our user experience more towards a content first versus a location first.
If I am a Plex subscriber or user, and I am getting my live TV, my local news affiliate, because I love my local news guys, I trust them more than anybody, and I travel, can I still get my local news?
Yeah, because we've had questions in the past of like, well, is that kind of like Aereo? Wasn't that illegal?
Well, I was wondering exactly that. Like, how did you do? Yeah, I was the one actually was like, how did you do what he didn't do?
So the difference is what Aereo, and I think there are others that kind of did the same thing, is they were hosting tuners, I think like somewhere within range of the Empire State Building or something like that. I can't remember what the story was, but they basically hosted a bunch of tuners for you. So you didn't have to have a tuner in your house getting your content in. In our case, this is content that you record, somewhat like it's almost like a Sling TV for over the air free content, right? So now you can go buy a tuner that costs, you know, anywhere between $100 and $200, depending on how fancy you want it. If you want multiple streams, et cetera, buy that little tuner box and you buy a little antenna, and in, you know, most 85% of the country, you now have tons of channels available to you, ABC, CBS, NBC, and you have that all for free, and it's uncompressed over the air HD. It's actually better quality than cable. But the most important thing is you bought the tuner, it's in your house. That's what the laws are designed to do, is to make sure that you can get that content into your home. And once you've done that and you've legally recorded it, we're not hosting it for you, we're not doing anything like that, then you can get access to it just like, you know, you could access your Sling or whatever.
So I see. So because my home is still my home and my home is recording my local channel, the fact that I'm traveling and accessing it via my phone, it's sort of linking back to my home and my tuner. That's the difference.
It was funny. I had, again, can't name names, but talking to a fairly senior guy in the industry who was saying, look, the way I'm going to do Aereo, but I'm going to do it differently. I'm going to basically rent out little 6 inch by 6 inch apartments to people. And that's their resume. I'm like, what? Like all these crazy things to kind of get past the laws, but we're not. We're not going to be leading the charge on changing the law there. I think we just want to take advantage of the technology that exists and stay within the framework of the way it works today.
So with all this over the air stuff coming in, that means all the advertisements are served up as well, right? So and essentially you've got people who maybe were cord cutters or cord nevers who all of a sudden are getting advertisements maybe they wouldn't get.
That's right.
So are you serving back to your partners viewing information?
We don't, because I think the way, I honestly don't even know exactly how that works, but I think the Nielsen and ratings, like they're getting, that's how they count on that data. Where we will, for example, so you mentioned local news, like you love your local news. In addition to getting that so you love your local news, you may want to cut the cord because you don't need all of the stuff that cable has to offer, but you're also not up for going out and buying a tuner and an antenna and setting that up. You just want to get your news. That's what WatchUp brings us, is that is going to be fully streamed. We have deals directly with publishers and pull that content in. And we think maybe the most, there's nobody doing this, I think, is well. We're just literally about to launch this. This is going to be in a few weeks. Again, it's already announced earlier this year, but in a few weeks, we hope to launch this. But one of the big differentiators is local news. We have, right. I think, 90% of, at least in the U.S., and we're continuing to build regionally outside of the U.S., but in the U.S., we have 90% of the major markets covered. So you'll more than likely be able to get your local news coverage in streaming in app. And again, that's all based on arrangements and deals that we have directly with those partners. And in that case, then we are actually participating in the ad process. We have deals to share ad revenue, and we'll insert ads into that content.
So you can do programmatic advertising at that point for them. Oh, great. That's really fantastic. And so that must have taken a while to put together.
Yeah, it took a little longer. Like we announced the acquisition in January and hope to have it out on first apps in the first half of the year. The big issue for us, because the Watch app infrastructure is all really solid and good. The issue for us is app development. We have so many, you know, we have so many apps, and we're trying to get features out, and things got kind of clogged with the live TV announcement. So like you said, your kind of thinking was, oh, well, maybe, you know, they announced news and maybe they use that to build live TV. It was just that live TV was already in the pipeline, and we had to kind of get that work done. That is, we're close on most of the live TV stuff on all of the apps, and the team's been cranking on news for the last few months. So hopefully we're close on all of that.
Have you noticed since the acquisition a change in what the most used device app is on your platform or your app? Sorry.
No, it's funny. Is if you look at, we don't publish those numbers specifically, but I can definitely give you. If you look at the most used app, my guess is it would map almost perfectly to market share. Like on the, you know, for OTT apps like Roku. We've been on Roku for a long time, and like I said, we're in the top 10, typically most watched app on there, depending on, sometimes we'll bump to 11 or 12 if other people are goosing their app with ad dollars and whatnot. But that is definitely our top app. But then if you kind of look at the rest of them, I think it goes down basically based on market share. On the mobile side, we're still a little, you know, relative to unit market share, Android versus iOS. They're both very, very strong, but we're probably a little bit stronger iOS. And I think that's because if you look at our audience, it's typically a little more techie,
right,
a little more adopter, and a little more affluent. So they've got money. And so the iOS and Apple contingent is probably higher than the market, kind of general market share.
Right, right. That makes sense. One of the things, and it's sort of tangential to the product discussion, but I'm curious about is your workforce and your distributed workforce. I mean, we were talking before the podcast actually launched about having team meetings, and you have a global team sitting together. Yep. Now, how the remote work pioneer, some companies are starting to phase that out. It was a big thing. And then people are like, you know what, the creativity, we need people together. How are you finding as you grow, having this remote workforce working?
Yeah. So you can get me started. I can do a whole, like, five podcasts. but I'll tell you, I'm very, very, first of all, very proud of our team. It's an amazing team. But if you talk about kind of remote in general, I think there is some misinformation out there. When you read stories about people pulling back on remote because it's quote unquote not working, if you read between the lines, and again, won't name any names, but in a lot of those cases, I think that's excuses for cutting back costs, where people say, oh, you know, because then if you look a year later, they still have a huge remote workforce, but they're using that as an excuse to trim costs because they know people aren't going to be willing to relocate to areas. And that may sound a little cynical, but I think that's by and large what's happening. I think especially in a software world, it is absolutely better to have a distributed and remote workforce for a bunch of reasons. Obviously for cost, I think makes most sense. You know, I think, but that's probably 10th on the list of why you would do it. I think from our perspective, it allows us to get the best person for the job wherever they are. And if you're all, you know, if you're trying to get your whole workforce to be within 10 miles of some little spot in the Silicon Valley, you're going to have to compromise on getting the right person for the right job is my guess. Mm-hmm. I think the other issue there with kind of co-location is, especially for a company like us, who's building a app that is, you know, wants to be tailored to the global markets and to lots of different places, having people sensitive to those issues in different areas, having designers spread out and your developers spread out and whatnot, I think helps us build. It's tough to, you know, show it in black and white or, you know, exactly why it's the case. But I absolutely believe that we're able to build an app that's, you know, more sensitive to more cultures by, you know, being represented by those cultures. So, and then I think in terms of does remote workforce work or not, and what are those challenges? The only real challenge that you kind of can't, that you have to really deal with is time zone issues.
Right.
In terms of, you know, location, being able to talk to somebody, you know, having a Zoom like this or a Google Hangout, or, you know, we use Slack. We're one of the first Slack customers. You know, we use Slack religiously. I think the ability to communicate and the ability to provide visibility, there's really nothing diminished there. And I always argue to people that I actually think our visibility and the context that we provide our employees and the kind of transparency that we have is way higher than any company. And I've worked for great companies, mm-hmm. but what we have way higher than any company I worked for, because you don't assume context. Like, I think people, if everybody's in the same building, leadership just kind of assumes, well, they're here, they know, like, of course they're just kind of get it. We kind of can't assume any of that. So we almost go overboard making sure that people have the context that they want.
Hmm. That's an interesting point, that, because you're absolutely right. People assume somehow by osmosis, because you're in the elevator banks, that you have gotten it.
I've been, as a leader, I was guilty. I've been guilty of that in the past, I know as well. So anyway, I personally think, you know, there's ebbs and flows, and certainly, you know, the, you know, big companies saying, hey, we're pulling back on remote workforces, we're pulling back on this, like that gets big news. But I think this is a wave that will continue, and especially in service, you know, in services fields or in software fields and things like that, where you just don't need to be all in the same place. It's a better way to go.
So do you actively recruit internationally so you'll have a distribution globally?
Yes. We've been really fortunate in that, again, because of our user base, it's a very technical user base. We've gotten a lot of our employees from, you know, they were users first and they're like the most avid users. So I cannot tell you how many times I've heard people say, like, oh my God, I cannot believe I'm actually going to work for my favorite thing on the planet. Like, so that we've been kind of lucky in that regard. But when we recruit, we actively recruit outside of the US and certainly outside of the Silicon Valley. It doesn't, you know, we have a little office here in Los Gatos that I'm in now, you know, mainly for partner meetings and things like that. And so we have some folks around the Silicon Valley as well. It's not like we're anti-Silicon Valley, but we're absolutely, we absolutely make a conscious effort to make sure the team is distributed.
Looking at markets like India and China, you're global, you're there as well.
We are there. It's funny, you just mentioned the two countries that we have the least penetration.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's okay. It's one of those things we don't really understand, because our growth has been so organic. We've had very little over the last year or so. We've definitely started testing the waters with like Facebook and Google advertising and things like that. But for the most part, it's all been organic, and it's always been kind of like, I wonder why is it that we're not seeing, you know, growth in India or China, but we see massive growth in Australia. So if you look at kind of our distribution, US is definitely the biggest. I think then it's Canada. It's either Canada or the UK, and then Australia, and then a number of European countries. And for some reason, Asia just hasn't kicked off well. And to be fair, just resource constraint, we haven't built a little business development team out there to go and try and kick up the dust. And from what I understand, again, I don't know much about the market, but from what I understand, given the way the kind of corporations work and the way the corporations are tied together there, you talk to folks in the Silicon Valley that say you really need to get feet on the ground to help you kind of navigate those waters. And we've just not done that yet.
Right, right. I was thinking really in terms of growing middle class, you know, because of the size of some of these places. And also, I was curious about language and whether it was sort of English and or, you know, Northern European languages,
yeah,
you know, romance so languages.
fairly early, we did very broad language translation. So like we are kind of in most major languages, including Chinese and others. But I do think we probably, if we had somebody dig in really hard there, just the idioms that we use, like things probably don't translate really well over, but the UI and the website and all that stuff is actually localized into most of those languages.
Hmm. Interesting. Fascinating. Well, I have used up my time with you. I appreciate it so much. I could keep going on and on. So we've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest, Keith Valerie. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.